And welcome to The Bunker. I'm Roz Taylor. The Lords is the largest upper chamber in the world outside China. From the Earl of Effingham to Lord Lebedev, who has spoken only once in the House and never voted, it is one of the weirdest institutions in British life.
Know ye that we, of our especial grace, certain knowledge and mere motion, in pursuance of the Life Peerages Act 1958, and of all other powers in that behalf us enabling, do by these presents advance, create and prefer our trusty and well-beloved Charlotte Catherine Tranter Owen to the state, degree, style, dignity, title and honour of Baroness Owen of Alderley Edge.
There are nearly 800 of them. The one you just heard introduced to the Lords is a 30-year-old who worked briefly for Boris Johnson but has no other special qualification to sit in Britain's upper chamber. How do you get in there? Why do people never leave? And does it have to be this way? With me to answer those questions is Darren Hughes, who's Chief Executive of the Electoral Reform Society. Welcome to The Bunker, Darren.
Thank you.
While the Lords seems a peculiar way to organise a legislative chamber now, 25 years ago it was even worse, wasn't it?
Oh, it sure was. And the Blair Labor government made some big changes, which was to get rid of a chamber that was full of hereditary peers. So the aristocrats used to have the say in the second chamber. And there were some life peers as well that were political appointments, but largely it was people who were there by right of birth. And there was a decision to modernise the second chamber, and that work started but was paused because this is a very difficult topic to try and get reform on. So it's come a long way in that time, but there's still a lot of work to do to make it into a proper functioning democratic chamber accountable to the British people.
It seems strange in a way that it's only 25 years ago that our upper chamber was dominated by hereditaries. Nowadays it seems almost unthinkable, but New Labour swept away most of the hereditary peers, but crucially not all of them, and 92 of them remain. The hereditary peerage is actually a lot bigger than that, of course. A lot of them were removed. So how are the lucky ones chosen?
Well, there's still about 800 who are on the official hereditary list of people with this right of birth status, but only 92 of them are able to be in the House of Lords at any one time. And basically, it was a deal that was done around the New Labour time because they were finding it so hard to get the reform through. Obviously, to pass a law, it needs to go through Parliament. Parliament has two chambers, the House of Commons, where there was a strong majority for change, and the House of Lords, which were the people being asked to vote themselves out of existence. And so the only way in the face of that, you know, wild opposition was to come up with this compromise of 92. The biggest bulk are reserved for Conservatives. The next biggest group is the Liberal Democrats, and then there are a couple for Labour. And then there's also people who are non-affiliated to a party or crossbenchers, etc. But those 92, when they either retire or pass away, they can only be replaced from within the ranks of the 800 aristocrats who then vote according to whatever block they line up with. So we're in a weird situation where in a second chamber, the only people who are actually elected are the hereditary peers, but they're elected from the world's strangest constituency.
And there's a built-in bias towards Conservatives in that constituency.
There's a built-in bias towards the Conservatives, absolutely. That's a matter of record because these party blocks are frozen in time as they were in the end of the 1990s. But there's also another terrible bias, which is that they are all men. So although there are some women who hold these titles outside of the House of Lords, because for so long it went to the eldest son as opposed to the eldest child. So there's 92 guaranteed seats for men from hereditary backgrounds in our parliament. So I think a lot of people listening to that will just think that that can't be right. But I'm afraid, dear listener, it is.
So who appoints the Lords?
Well, in the strictest of sense, they're appointed by the sovereign, by the king. But in reality, the main way they're appointed is by the prime minister of the day nominating them through the process. Now, there's a body called the House of Lords Appointments Commission, and they were given a task around the time of these reforms we've been mentioning at the end of the 90s to come up with at least a couple of people a year, if they wanted to, who'd be, you know, the people that are often promoted as being the shining lights of the House of Lords, which are independent people, maybe people with expertise in a particular area, crucially non-partisan people. And so they have a role in coming up with some names, and they've done that over the last 25 years, but they also play a role in and running a ruler over the names that the Prime Minister puts forward. But essentially, the Prime Minister sets the timetable for it, decides how many there will be, consults other party leaders, because as part of the package, the Prime Minister might go to the Leader of the Opposition and say, I'm doing a round of appointments to the Lords and you can have a few, but I'll have more.
So we have a situation where party leaders and ex-PMs nominate a lot of peers, but the original intention was that the House of Lords Appointments Committee, which you just mentioned, would pick people with expertise to go into the Lords, wasn't it? And yet they've only chosen four people from that route in the past 5 years. Why?
I suspect that one of the main reasons is that the House of Lords has become flooded with the patronage route. The three ways of getting into the House of Lords really are hereditary, which we've discussed, spiritual, if you're a bishop in the Church of England, or patronage, if you are a friend or a donor or a pal or an ally of a prime minister or a party leader. And so because the numbers have now swelled to around 800, so it's much bigger than the House of Commons, the elected chamber, I suspect that the HOLAC, as it's known, hasn't wanted to add to that burden of the big numbers that are there. But it has meant that people who are non-partisan, who might want to go for a certain amount of time and then step away, people who aren't as interested in the cut and thrust of following the party whip like the political appointees are, those people really haven't had the chance to come through in the way that was originally envisaged.
Yeah, because in theory, anyone can nominate themselves to join the Lords. There's actually a method on the website where you can apply. Does anyone actually do that?
I'm sure they do, but they don't get very far.
No.
And
you
know, and I think the other problem is that because there's been this fixation on life appointments, if that committee's been going for 25 years, putting up a few people every year, and at the beginning they did do quite a few, there's a you know, a list of very prominent and accomplished people who were on that list at the beginning, but many of them are still alive today in the 2020s, and so you begin to see that this issue about recognising somebody with a job for life means that you're cramming out the space. Whereas, you know, I think if it was more linked to the notion of terms of service, which is mainly how we consider things in a democratic sense, then there'd be more space coming through rather than people who were, you know, probably absolutely experts on something 20 years ago. Doesn't necessarily mean that all of us will be experts, you know, all that time later.
Is there any limit on the size of the Lords?
There's no limit. There's been calls for it to be reduced. Well, there's obviously calls for it to be abolished and replaced with an elected chamber, but there have been formulas which the Lords themselves have come up with to try and get the numbers down. There was the committee that came forward a few years ago saying, you know, for every one person that comes in who's new, two people must go out. And that's one of those mechanisms that people happily agree with until they realise they're one of the people that's being discussed. And so we haven't seen that kind of willing set of retirements in a big number. I mean, some do retire because now they can keep the title, but it's nowhere near enough because so many recent prime ministers have been nominating so many people that the numbers just keep going up and up. And then you get another category of people who decide to step away from active service, maybe to pursue business interests, and so don't want to come under the transparency and disclosure regimes of the House of Lords. And so they keep their membership, but they're not on active service until whatever other avenues they're pursuing have come to a conclusion.
Which seems very strange, because if you're appointed to the House of Lords, surely you have a responsibility to serve your country. It's a huge honour. But you can just step away and say, I don't need to declare anything, I don't need to do anything, I'm taking this time out, maybe I'll come back.
Correct. I mean, it's entirely subjective. So one of the criteria for the nominations that come through from HOLAC is making sure that the people have the time necessary to put into the job, because this is about scrutiny and revising legislation, coming up with amendments, etc. It's often quite detailed work. It's quite thorough work. It's not the sort of thing you can glance over a piece of paper and then say, I'm ready to go. You do need to put in the hard yards to be effective. But people can tell you when they're being sworn in and when there's some media attention on them, I intend to be a full and functioning working member of the House of Lords. But as time goes by, there's no mechanism really to keep track of that. The only accountability factor is that by not attending, they can't claim the tax-free allowance, which is over £300 per day.
So defenders of the Lords say that they scrutinise legislation in a way that the Commons can't be bothered to do. So why meddle with something that works? Let's hear Baroness Butler Sloss on what she thinks would be lost if the Lords were abolished.
I think it would be disastrous. The Commons not only produces incomplete and very often nowadays badly drafted bills, which we put to rights in the Lords and for which they are actually grateful,
turkeys don't vote for Christmas and all that, as we've just been saying, but does she have a point?
I think there's certainly a job to be done. I think the idea that you have a second chamber that takes a longer-term view than maybe the day-to-day cut and thrust of politics that the House of Commons is required to do, I think a second chamber that can dedicate its time to detailed scrutiny of legislation to make sure it's achieving its policy intent with the clauses and the words that are in the legislation. These are all very worthy tasks. And in a strange kind of way, the recent rolling controversy about the House of Lords has demonstrated two things. One, often the Lords have stepped in to make sensible changes to things that are a little bit of a rush of blood to the head, if you want to put it that way, from the House of Commons. And that shows the task of a scrutiny chamber.
Like the illegal migration bill, for example?
Well, many examples of amendments that, if they hadn't have come from the House of Lords, would have sailed through on a winner-takes-all House of Commons with a government that doesn't have a majority of the public but has a majority of the seats because of our voting system, and there'd be no handbrake. So I think that does demonstrate the need. But at the same time, you've had prime ministers misusing this patronage angle that they have to load up the place with people who really, you know, the most objective observer would say aren't required to be there, if I can put it politely. And so at the same time, you've got these dueling and conflicting things happening where the function is being demonstrated as required, but the structure is being shown to be so wanting. And I think until that tension is resolved, all of the good work of the second chamber is going to be totally overshadowed by these failings and by the way it's being let, the British people are being let down with the current setup.
Would it help if the Appointments Commission had more power? Because we know that they rejected some of Boris Johnson's nominees for a peerage, but not all of them. Mm. And as we know, there's been controversy over his selections, to put it mildly. Since they have been unable to stop a 30-year-old who briefly worked for Boris Johnson being nominated, who really doesn't seem qualified to take up such a senior and important role, do we need to give them more power, or is the problem wider and we just need to revisit the whole structure?
Well, I think the latter is the most important point, because we can't keep carrying on like this. But to the first point, I think it does need more power in the interim, because we've relied on the judgment of prime ministers not to push it too far, not to overdo it, and to make sensible decisions. Now, Boris Johnson is the only prime minister since Tony Blair, and there's been quite a few. He is the only one to have overruled a recommendation from the committee saying, look, don't make this appointment. So once I think you go down that path of prime ministers saying, I'm going to bash through what the referee says and I'm going to bust through the norms of good behaviour on these matters, then it shows that the system can't work. And therefore, I think you do need to toughen up. And I think the reason why some of the names he put forward didn't make it through was not only because HOLAC were prepared to take a stand on it, but also they knew that the incumbent prime minister would back them on it. Whereas if it had been a different personality, like some of the ones we've seen recently, they might have just said, well, you know, I'm keen on making sure my resignation list gets through, therefore I better honour a previous person's resignation list. And, you know, don't forget, we still have the Liz Truss list to come. So you know, the fireworks are not over yet in this respect. And I think that we do need to have thorough democratic reform of an institution that is no longer working in the way that its task would require it to work. But I think in the meantime, until we can get to that phase, there needs to be a lot more powers given to this independent body to ensure that their thorough work is taken seriously.
Do you want to see an elected Lords?
I think it's absolutely critical. I think the Lords should be a lot smaller. We do not need 800 people. It should be smaller by definition in the House of Commons. It should be term limited, so people don't go there for life. And it should have a democratic mandate from the public. And that might mean, you know, one single long term, for example, so that people aren't campaigning politicians worried about re-election, but at least their day-to-day work has been derived by the mandate of the public. And I think that would also be an opportunity to use proportional representation, because then we could counter some of the big problems with the current setup, which is its domination by London and the Southeast and by the big political parties. So you could have the smaller parties, the parties from the nations and regions of the UK, much more represented, but also under a PR system, you could get independent people standing saying, I'd like to do a single term in the House of Lords or whatever it would be called, the second chamber, but I don't have a party affiliation. Well, under our current voting system, that's really hard to achieve. So I think, you know, we could make some real changes to reduce the size, broaden out its appeal, both in terms of geography and in terms of diversity, and also bring in more political voices than exist right now with the two-party club.
Gordon Brown has put forward plans for reforming the Lords a few months ago, and one of the things he wants to do is to rebalance it, as you suggest, more sort of regional basis, so you'd make sure you had enough people from the regions and the nations. What did he recommend, and do you think his plans are a good idea?
I really welcome what he's suggesting because for a few reasons. Number one, he describes it as indefensible. So rather than playing along with let's see if we can fix it internally chaps kind of theory, you know, it's a very senior public figure or a former prime minister or a former long-term chancellor coming out and saying this is indefensible. So I like that. It shifts the grounds of the debate. The second thing I like is that he links it with the economic and social justice performance of the UK as well. So tying together what happens in our economic and social life with our democratic life. And I think that's a really important thing because otherwise people can look at this and say, this all seems esoteric. Why are you wasting time and money on that? But what I liked about his report was that he tried to frame it in terms of, you know, where are there issues in society and the economy in the UK and how can democratic structures assist that? Now, that's not a right-wing or left-wing argument because we'll have contested elections and there'll be governments formed from either side over time. But this notion that the public policy challenges they want to address are weaved in with our democratic institutions supporting that, I think is a really good concept. I think that's what's kept it alive rather than making it a doorstopper kind of report. And then the third thing, I think, is introducing that democracy element and bringing in more nations, the people of the nations and the regions of the UK, and finding a role for some of our other devolved structures like the metro mayors that have developed in recent times and big voices in parts of England that don't otherwise necessarily get heard. And the Brown model would bring them into that as well. So there's a lot in there, I think, that people should look at. And they should look at it not as a suggestion by a Labour politician. They should look at it as a suggestion from a statesman thinking about the long-term interests of the country.
So the problem with Lords reform, of course, is that while most people seem to agree that the system is very flawed, it's never seen as urgent. There's always something that must be fixed first. Do you think Keir Starmer will follow through? Is he going to implement Brown's proposals?
Well, I really hope he will, and I hope that the Brown proposals give a cohesive and rigorous sense as to why it's important to do. Political parties often have a reference in their manifesto to fixing the House of Lords, and then, you know, it never seems to be a priority. I think going back to what Brown's done, he's not just pitched it in terms of looking at it just from the lens of democracy. He's tried to link it to economics. And I think that opens up a new way of discussing and thinking about our structures and the public life of the UK. And that to me is worthwhile doing. I also think that if Keir Starmer wants to not just win one election, but presumably win one after that as well, he needs to think from early doors what structures he needs to be an effective prime minister. And I think what the Brown report has done is laid out some reforms of how he could be the Prime Minister of the whole United Kingdom and having an institution down the corridor which had genuine nations and regions, thoughtful representation and bringing in some of these mayors and really straightening the place out. I think, you know, for a new government, that would be something that would be a useful thing to have. I suppose the tendency is of all new governments is to think that the whole world has changed by virtue of their election and that they've arrived with these good intentions and those good intentions are enough. But I think what we've seen in recent years is if you don't have the institutional settings right, you're really at risk if things go wrong, if things go in a different direction. And I think, you know, that's something that people in the United States are also considering. And it's what we should really get ahead of the game here and take this good proposal and turn it into something concrete. I also think that, you know, this basic principle, if you're going to live in a country and follow the laws of a country, you should get a say in the people who are writing those laws.
It was reported a few weeks ago that Keir Starmer wanted to actually pack the Lords with Labour-appointed peers in order to get the legislation through that he wants to get through. Now, it may be that the legislation he wants to get through is to abolish the Lords itself, in which case, great. But there is a risk, isn't there, that he just uses it for his own purposes and then never reforms it?
Huge risk. And I think that history has a way of repeating itself on some of these things. You know, I mean, it's easy to be tough on politicians. They're human beings like the rest of us, and we all find ways of justifying our existence at various points. And what can happen, I think, in that situation is people get there, they quite like it, it's collegial. They feel like they're doing important work, and oftentimes they are doing very important work. And so this idea of, I'll just stay one more year, I'll just do one more term. So I think that if, you know, I think we've got 800 people, that's more than enough. If the Leader of the Opposition has a clear manifesto and wins an election, then there are conventions in the House of Lords about following what is in a manifesto. I don't really buy this thing that they need to stack it with lots and lots of people from their own party to counter what, you know, Johnson et al. Have done in the last decade and a half or so. However, I do take the practical point that if they want people to help them pass their program, that might be one way they have to do it, if that's their view. If I was in Keir Starmer's shoes, I would, in addition to handing over a letter of appointment, I'd ask for a future undated letter of resignation from the recipient so that he can call time on it all, because these things have a way of, you know, moss and rolling stones and all these sort of things. And I think there's a moment here. I mean, we're finally at a point where a lot of the public are noticing that our democratic institutions are at risk from bad behaviour. And before that gets out of hand, there's a chance for that to be cleaned up. And I think it would be a grave mistake to justify something on the basis of we just need to do this temporarily, and then another 25 years goes by and we've not moved much further on it. So I think there'll be a real risk that in order to please some very worthy political activist or whatever, they get given a job. The risk there is that that they lose the faith of the public pretty quickly. And I think, you know, new governments have very small windows to show they're different. And this would be a really strong sign for a new government to show that they're different, because they'd be effectively reforming their own industry, which, as we've discussed, is often a very difficult thing to be brave enough to do.
It is. Clause 4, maybe. Darren, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You can support us to keep making podcasts for less than 1/100th of the daily fee for turning up at the Lords. Just search Patreon Bunker Podcast. I'm Ros Taylor, and thanks for listening. Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now?, the politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election, and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof, or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fern, guest Nikki McCann-Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Bunker was written and presented by Ros Taylor. The producer was Kasia Tomaszewicz, with audio production by me, Simon Williams. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis. The group editor is Andrew Harrison, with music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by James Parrott. The Bunker is a Podmasters production.